Why do you say that, Father? You aren't afraid, are you?
No. But I respect some of the superstitions of others. Often they are founded in fact.
Broadcasting live from our Sanctum Sanctorum in Venice, California, this is the Sixth Sense Society. I'm your host, Krista, here with our producer, Michael, and today we're really excited to have on the show Sarah Mastros, who is Pittsburgh's leading witch for hire. She is the author of the Orphic Hymns Grimoire, the Big Book of Magical Incense, and the forthcoming The Sorcery of Solomon, a guide to the 44 Pentacles of the Magician King. She's best known for her teaching online and at festivals all over the East Coast. Among her areas of expertise are tarot, witchcraft, Greek and Near Eastern mythology, Pan-Levitan folk magic, and Solomonic sorcery. In addition to Sarah's teaching and practice, along with her partners at Quicksilver Cards and Games, she owns FoolsDog.com, the market-leading digital tarot publishing company. And today we welcome her on the show to talk about witchcraft as a craft versus a religion, and also some other places the conversation will naturally go. She's got a lot of experience, and we're really excited to have her on the show. But before we get started, Michael does have a few announcements.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to our show, and it's really great to have you guys here. I'm super excited to have Sarah on today. We've got some great guests coming up. Next week, we have a show on Aleister Crowley and his magic for everyone. We're Sarah Mastros, who's a Thelemite and an occultist.
I'm Sarah Mastros.
Oh, I'm sorry. You are. I apologize that.
Lynn
Maeve, there we go, who is a Thelemite occultist and so forth. Apologies to Sarah. And then UFOs with Preston Dennett at the end of the month. And he's a very established and published author, dozens of books on the subject. So we have a lot of fun with that. And get all the information on our website, sixthsensesociety.com, S-I-X-T-H, all spelled out. And while you're there, if you can afford to, buy us a coffee on Ko-Fi. But the best thing you can do is click like and subscribe on our YouTube channel, and that helps a lot. And I'm going to blame all of this rambling on my flu. I took some flu medicine, so I'm a little out of it. So with that, I better shut up and hit it back to Krista. We're going to have a miserable show, so take it away, Krista.
Thank you, Michael. And I believe it's Lynn Mavius is the name of our next week's guest. So, but welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're really excited to have you on. And what Michael and I were curious is, how did you get the title of Pittsburgh's leading witch for hire? It's very catchy.
Well, you know, there really aren't that many witches for hire in Pittsburgh, so it's a pretty simple playing field. You know, I thought a lot. So about 6 or 7 years ago, I quit my grown-up day job to witch full-time. And I don't know, I needed something to put on a business card. And I am just not very creative. So I was like, I'm a witch for hire. That's what I do. Witch for hire.
I thought it was very catchy. I liked it a lot. Yeah, and I think especially Pittsburgh. I don't think of Pittsburgh as a very, you know, witch-oriented city.
You know? You know, people say that, but it is perhaps the most magical place I've lived. Like, I live at a three-way crossroads made out of major rivers.
Oh, that's like, beautiful.
Pittsburgh is, like, is a place where, like, the land formation itself, right, is deeply magical. But it's also because of the geography, you know, this has been a crossroads, a cultural crossroads for 10, 15,000 years, the earliest well-documented carbon-dated site of human habitation in North America is about an hour away from where I live, which is weird because it's far from water. So how did they get there? We just have, like, nobody's saying humans started here. This is just where we found them.
Right.
And it's never been, like, it's always been cross-cultural, right? Like, so cultures moved in and out many, many, many times. And almost always this was sort of an important kind of coming together place because of that crossroads of rivers, right? It's a strategically valuable in a martial sense and also in a mercantile sense place. But also in a modern sense, like, Pittsburgh is still cheap to live in. So most of my coven lives less than 15 minutes away. And that, like, provides an opportunity for musicians and artists and witches to like actually live close enough to build real community in a way that like wasn't true when I lived in Philadelphia, that wasn't true when I lived in Connecticut or Los Angeles. Like it was just so expensive that nobody could actually afford to live in the city.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. I know my aunt moved out there for that reason. And she also told me that the artists and culturally it was growing a lot. And that was like, I think a decade ago.
Yeah, I think you hear a lot of talk about like, oh, keep this city or that city weird. Well, like keeping a city weird is 90% about not artificially inflating real estate costs through corporate ownership.
No kidding.
Like Pittsburgh, you know, has had our fair share of problems with gentrification, but because the population in Pittsburgh dropped precipitously when most of the steel mills closed, like there's still a substantial amount of excess housing in Pittsburgh, and that keeps it cheap, and that keeps it with like weird unemployed ne'er-do-wells like me come up here.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true.
I'm quite committed to my unemployed ne'er-do-well lifestyle.
Yeah, I can understand that. Now let's start with the topic that at large and see where we go with it. So we wanted to talk about the idea of witchcraft as a religion versus a craft. And so let's start with that concept and go from there. So what is your main opinion about that question? Is it a witch? Is it a craft? Is it a religion? Is it both?
So, you know, I'm a big believer that language analysis, right, is only useful descriptively and not prescriptively. So we can't tell people what a word should mean. We can just look at how people use words and talk about how they use them. And for the overwhelming majority of the history of the English language, witchcraft was unquestionably a craft that the Christian church understood as heretical to their religion, right? But which other religions didn't necessarily, right? But it was unquestionably a craft and not a religious pursuit, right? I feel like I'm not exactly sure when that started to change in English. I would guess maybe the late 70s, right? With the sort of rise of and popularization of Wicca, people started to use witchcraft to describe religious practices. Personally, I don't like to use the word witchcraft that way because then I don't have a word for the craft that witches practice, right? I feel like if we imagine in our head what a witch is and like what makes someone a witch, it is their practice of the craft of witchcraft, right?
Right.
Which is about, you know, practical operative magic. Right. So for me, when I use the word witchcraft, I definitely mean a craft, but I mean, I'm not the language police. People can use words. How about it?
It's an interesting, really, and a deep question, I think, because I came across, you might be familiar with this book, but I came across this book, Changeling, A Book of Qualities by Aidan Wachter, W-A-C-H-T-E-R.
I know him, but I don't know that book.
It's actually quite different from any witchcraft book I've ever read, just the way he even writes it. It's not like a, you know, sort of like do this or this ritual. He has these qualities he talks about. And he also says that he believes witchcraft is a craft. And he thinks that, you know, charms are a huge part of this craft. I mean, obviously there are other things too. But he made me start to think about that. What you already have been doing is thinking about the craft of witchcraft in and of itself, and that you can learn this craft and the importance. And also, you know, he seems to be, you know, kind of like do your own thing to some degree. So he's not trying to be a dogmatic person. But I like the way the book is written because it's so different from any kind of witchcraft book I've ever written. It's actually beautifully written, too. And it's very poetic at times and philosophical. But you got me. That was about a year ago. And then having you on the show, I thought, yeah, I really want to understand this more. And what does that mean? And what are some of the skills that you would sort of think would be important in someone seeking maybe a foundation in the craft of witchcraft?
Well, that's a really good question, right? So I teach an introductory class where I sort of go over what I think of as sort of fundamental spells or fundamental skills, right? And I think of them as sort of breaking into a couple of categories, right? And so the first category is what we traditionally call sympathetic magic. That is to say, magic that essentially relies on symbolism, right? So if you're trying to curse someone, you might make a doll that looks like them and stick pins into it, right? That's sort of a very traditional form of sympathetic magic. And it sort of relies on a principle of relationship between like a symbol and its referent, right? So if I do things to the doll and the doll is in some way an image, a symbol of the person, right? Then there's that relationship there that I can piggyback magic along, right? So that's sort of one like sort of fundamental witchcraft skill, I think, right? And along with that is the notion that, like, you know, things have their own innate virtues, right? So, like, when we talk about sort of magical herbalism, right? That the biological and, like, chemical and ecological properties of a plant, that knowing those allows you to translate into these more magical virtues, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, I know that almost anything that can be used to induce an abortion, right, is also excellent for necromancy, right, and is excellent for working with, say, the queens of hell, and also is going to be good for evocation of thonic, of underworld spirits, right? That there's a relationship between chemical properties, right? Physical properties, between like the role that a plant plays in its ecosystem, right? In it, in invisible nature, and the role that it plays in invisible nature, right? So in sympathetic magic, there is also this aspect of, like, you know, plants and I guess crystals. Personally, I'm not that into crystals. In fact, my godmother recently said something interesting. She said that almost everybody is either a plant, like in terms of witchcraft, is either a plant person or a stone person, but rarely both. And that was interesting.
I think that's true.
I'm definitely a plant person, and I'm like not that into rocks. I mean, it's not that I think they're not effective or like I'm down on like crystal people, but like they just don't really speak to me the way that plants do, right? And so that's sort of like understanding the virtues of different materials is also part of sympathetic magic, right? And I think that's sort of the first core skill that I start teaching, right? I think that there is a skill that is sort of rooted in animism, right? In this idea that things are awake and alive and you can interact with people that aren't humans, this more or less the same way you interact with people who are humans, right? That like I can have a relationship with a tree, or I can have a relationship with a ghost, or I can have a relationship with a river god, the same way that I build relationships with people, right? That there is an alliance and a partnership, mm-hmm. and that those are my neighbors and I just interact with them, right? There's sort of that kind of beginner sort of spirit magic, right? Which is in some ways partly a skill, right? There's a developed mediumship, an ability to like hear and know and see and interact with the invisible world, mm-hmm. right? Then sort of the psych is a mediumship type category. But a lot of it is about really just a change in frame of reference. Like that's very different than the way many people sort of are taught to behave in our culture, although it is the natural human method of behaving. It is a behavior that like all three-year-olds or almost all three-year-olds interact with the world in that way. It's the natural way of being, and we are taught out of that way. And then there's sort of like an internal energy practice, right? So things like yoga and qigong is another, what I think of as sort of like fundamental magical skill. And I would say in some ways those kind of three streams, right? Sympathetic magic, spirit magic, and energy work in some ways sort of braid together. That I would say like most fundamental magical skills are like some kind of combination of those three. So I start off talking about them individually, and then we move into sort of like more elaborate practices that kind of braid them together. So things like, here, the last lesson I teach, right? I'm about to, tomorrow, actually, I'm teaching lesson 12 of 13, which is on shape changing, and lesson 13 of 13 is on transpossession, right? So that's sort of the last thing I teach is like, you know, opening your mouth and having someone else's voice come out.
Yeah, that's always a little intense to me. Now what you're talking about,
lessons in by then, you know.
Now, I don't remember what I was watching. I was watching a fairly young woman who's was quite popular on YouTube talking about more of the herbal side of witchcraft. And I think it was her or someone else maybe that was talking about there was no need to have any kind of, I want to say, spiritual connection to witchcraft. It sounded like it was just empty of all that. She didn't use the word religion, I remember, but it sort of made me think, like, I don't think that's possible to not have any, whatever you call it, whether you just call it, like,
I mean,
life force, chi, that it's not, it seemed a little too secular to me, you know, and there seems to be that idea that I just don't know that that's, like, literally possible if you just think of the idea that, you know, what you don't have to call it animism, you don't have to call it whatever, but there is some kind of a life force that permeates and that you learn to work with as a witch.
Well, I guess I would say I believe, partly simply as a matter of faith, but mostly just on like experience of the world, that like there is invisible stuff in the world, like that I am impacted by things I cannot know or understand. And whether I want to have a relationship with that or not, I do. And so I think like it's impossible to practice witchcraft while not being in relationship with that, whatever we want to call it. But I would also argue it's impossible to be alive without being in relationship with that. I mean, I think, you know, there are gray areas about like, is this witchcraft or not, right? So certainly my first co-magician, like my BFF witch that I came up with, like we met in Girl Scouts, is now a professor of botanical medicine.
Wow.
Right? So, I mean, independent of her personal beliefs, when she teaches herbalism in university, she is teaching it in a quite secular way. I mean, I don't think that is, that certainly exists. I mean, she also teaches acupuncture, right, in a secular way. She also teaches, I believe, I don't know if she teaches, her school also teaches, for example, like medical qigong, all of which they're doing in, I think, a relatively sort of normative American secular paradigm. So it's not that like, are those things witchcraft? I mean, in my opinion, when people make a big point about how you don't have to believe in ookity spook, it's because they want to distance themselves from the word witchcraft. So I guess what I'm saying is there's these gray areas, like, right, is this witchcraft or not? I don't know that there's a lot of like, I don't know. I mean, is what she's doing secular witchcraft or is it just biochemical herbalism? I don't know that it matters. Right. Like, you know, I was trained as a mathematician. Like that's what my graduate degree is in. So I like understand the value of tight precision in language and in thought, but I don't know that I think the value of talking about is this witchcraft or not lies only in the ability of like me a witch and you a witch to like form some kind of common vocabulary so we can talk about witchy shit.
Right.
Right. Like I don't.
Like it's a form of connecting.
I mean, I don't know. She's doing it. So obviously it can be done. Personally, it seems a little boring to me.
Yeah.
People
approach their paths in different ways and it goes where it's going to go. I think if people, you know, maybe they start one way and they find out something more about it. But language, I agree that it's witchcraft is kind of like what we decided is a good communication starting point. But I also, being a writer, I'd like to have the belief that we can learn to think about our words more thoughtfully and for instance, we were talking before the show, I was saying how, you know, witch has become so popular that almost anything is a witch now and everyone's a witch. And I don't think that's true either, because that doesn't make sense. It's almost like when, who was it? Was it the Jehovah Witnesses were claiming Anne Frank being Jewish? I don't know, something like that. It's not true. I mean, it's, no, not Jewish, but that they were, that she was it a Jehovah Witness or the Mormons wanted to claim Anne Frank because her lineage or something as part of them. And I said, well, no, she was Jewish. You can't make her into something she's not. And sometimes I think because of the popularity, which is kind of exciting on one level, it kind of basically washes away any of the real tenets of what maybe witchcraft is. And that's just me as a writer thinking like, well, words matter to me and maybe not to everybody.
I'm very careful with my language. Like, I would never use the word witchcraft to refer to religion. I mean, unless like I was in a context that someone else had set where that was what was clearly people meant. Like, I'm not going to fight about what the word means, but like, I definitely think it's a craft. I base this primarily on the fact that it has the word craft in it, which seems like hard evidence to dispute. I mean, here's the thing. People can think witchcraft means whatever they want, but then some ooky spooky witchcraft happens in front of them and they're like, holy shit, you're a fucking witch. And I'm like, yeah, I told you that the whole time. You just didn't believe me. Like, people know witchcraft when they see it.
Now, that's an interesting thing, too, is that from what I gather from you is that you really are into the idea of effective witchcraft and looking for things that work and that have an effect. And tell me sort of why you are like that and how you feel the larger culture is around this topic, actually.
I mean, I think generally for most things that I do, when I decide to do them, I have some reason. Like, there's an effect I want, not just in witchcraft, but like most of my life, I feel like if I'm doing something, there's some reason I'm doing it, right? And I want to know whether it worked or not. Like, did I actually get what I wanted out of it? And I think people are scared to do that with witchcraft because being effective, there being a metric of effectiveness implies that you can be bad at it. And I don't think people like the idea that you can be bad at witchcraft. But I think that's sad because things that you can't be bad at are things you can't get better at. But you can, like witchcraft, like any craft, you know, is about being good at it, is about some combination of like natural talent and hard work, and which includes basically just like experience and practice are all in that hard work category. Mm-hmm. And like good technique, like you've been taught properly, you know what you're doing. And I think of it in that way, very similar to say music or mathematics, right? Like, we all know that there's like some people are just innately good at music, right? Some people have a musical gift, and for example, I am deeply unmusical. Like, I, whatever that musician gift gene is, I do not have it, right? Like, I cannot carry a tune in a bucket using both hands. But like, I know that if I like sat down and learned to play piano and I practiced really hard, I could be a perfectly adequate piano player. But am I ever going to be like a musical genius? Probably not. Right? Because being like really, really great at something, I think you actually need all three of those components, right? Same thing with math, same thing with witchcraft. Like, some people do have an innate talent for it. And like any other innate talent, most people are kind of in the middle. Some people are like, I'm stunningly bad at music. Some people are stunningly bad at magic, right? And some people are really, really good at it, mm-hmm. right? But most people are kind of in the middle, and they can dramatically improve their game by learning proper techniques, right? And practicing. And I know that's like a really unfun, unsexy, like I know that's not like gonna take off on Instagram, my position that like it's a craft and you just learn to be better at it over time. Mm-hmm. But that's really my position on whichever. And I think that's good. Like, I like things that I can get better at. Mm-hmm. Like, I like knowing that if I work at things, I will improve.
It's also true that based on what you were talking about in terms of fundamentals, that a person could have a knack with certain aspects of magic and have to work harder at certain other aspects.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, or maybe their passion is also certain kinds of things and they become an expert in that area.
Certainly. I will say of those three strains, energy work is definitely like my weak spot. Like it does not come naturally to me. It's like a skill I worked hard to develop that I learned from other people, but I can like hear my internal martial arts friend in the back of my head being like, you don't work that hard at it though, because I don't. Like I know that if I went to Qigong class every day, I would get much better at it. And I don't do that.
Yeah. That's one of the, I've practiced, Tai Chi before, but I started Qigong during the pandemic. I decided just to do this YouTube and I did it every single day, literally. Mm-hmm. And I was amazed how it worked so easily, you know, and it's one of those things that, yeah, and some days you don't want to do it, even though it's pretty gentle movement. It's not like it's really arduous, but like any other discipline, there's days you really don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. And you're right. It's so to me, it sounds like discipline is part of, you know, becoming good at witchcraft in whatever area you want to.
Yeah, I mean, discipline's part of getting good at anything, yeah. Sadly.
Sadly.
Sadly. Like, I wish I didn't have to work at things, maybe. No, that'd probably be terrible.
It'd be like, boring, you know, if everything came easily, you know, like.
Yeah, and then there'd be no, like, yeah. I mean, I love learning things. So, like, you know, if you're good at everything right away, you don't get to have that, like, joy of the learning part, which I really like. But yeah, I mean, I think fundamentally learning witchcraft is very similar to learning most things. But I really think, to me, the metaphors I always come back to when I think about, like, teaching and learning are, like, music, which I'm very bad at, and math, which I'm very good at. Like, right? So I have a graduate degree in math. I taught math for many years. And I feel like thinking about those two things, like, really informs my understanding of, like, teaching witchcraft as well. But I think, yeah, I don't know. I think witchcraft is like most other human crafts and skills.
Mm-hmm. Now, it sounds like you have had a mix of learning on your own and working with others. What are your thoughts about, say, I'm brand new coming in? What would you suggest people do?
I think the single best thing you can do to learn magic is get a co-magician. Even more so than a teacher, a co-magician, like one, you know, we were talking about, like, I just don't go to Qigong class. Like, you know, a partner makes it easier. If you're responsible to somebody else for doing things, at least for me, I will actually do them. So, like, a co-magician gives you that. But they also force you to be able to, like, we were talking before about the value of language. They force you to be able to clearly articulate what you are talking about. Like, when it's all by yourself, you can kind of get in this place where you're kind of stringing yourself along, but, like, actually nothing you're saying makes any sense at all. Like, you were just high and you said some stuff and maybe there's an insight in there somewhere, but you have not done the work to, like, crystallize it, right? But having to put it into words for somebody else forces you to do that. And also, like, they keep you honest in both senses, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, if you're in the middle of ritual and, like, a spirit appears, 2 or 3 days later, it's really easy to talk yourself out of that. Like, oh, I was just really in the zone and, like, I imagined it. But when there's two of you, it's much harder to do that. Mm. And the other way as well, like, your co-magician will just call you when you're bullshit. They're like, no, that did not happen. Like, I didn't see that. I was there. Nothing happened. Right. And so I think that value of having somebody to practice with, ideally in person, but even, like, you know, video chat's not bad, mm-hmm. but it's not as good as in person. But that, I think, is the single biggest thing that will push people forward, because it also just makes it more fun.
It does. We did some sort of very spontaneous group magic when we first came to LA. And we'd just have, like, we knew some friends that were into magic and we would do something kind of just off the cuff. And and I luckily took notes. And I, even at the time, I didn't take great notes. Like, I thought, and I would have totally, totally forgotten. And some of the things that later came true from the group, especially when we did divination, we would do scrying together sometimes in a mirror. Mm-hmm. And we'd all, like, you know, see what we'd see, and I'd write it down, and I'd be like, oh my God, that happened, you know? And yeah. It was just, even in terms of just an experiment, and it was also really interesting with the, it was usually like 3 or 4 people. It was not a big thing. Mm-hmm. And people, we just had an affinity towards each other. And I have to admit, it was a very memorable and a really good learning experience, and it was effective, you know, even though I felt at times because we had different magical backgrounds, we were just kind of making it up as it goes because of that, how we would do it together as a group. And it was really interesting, you know, it really, like, to me, it also gives confidence in magic. Mm-hmm. Like, exactly. Even if you think you're not doing so well later, you're right. In the moment, you know, it's easier to say, oh my God, something's happening. And then later on, your ego might go, well, did that really happen? Or, you know, and mm-hmm. when you have other people there, like you said, they hold you accountable. Yeah, that really did. That spirit did say that, or we all saw that, or, you know. So you're right. I love that idea of having like a partner, you know, that you work together yeah. with right away.
Exactly. I think also like you were saying, like people come from these different backgrounds. And so you learn things that you wouldn't necessarily have picked up. So like I do a lot of plant magic, but that's because my first co-magician is like on the plant path, we would say, right? Like I said, she's a professor of botanical medicine. Like she's been into herbalism the whole time. So like, if I hadn't been friends with her, I mean, I'm sure I would have picked up a little bit of herbalism as like on the fringes of my witchcraft, but it's not necessarily something that I had a great passion for, but she did. So now my witchcraft is rooted in like pretty deep phytochemistry, right? Because I learned that with her, right?
Right.
Or my BFF now is like teaches Bagua and Tai Chi and Wushu, I don't even know, a variety of martial arts, primarily internal martial arts. And again, that's not a thing that I would necessarily be into, but he's so into it, I can't avoid it, right? And that's good for me, right? Like, I think that coming from different backgrounds, one, like, just gets you to explore things you wouldn't otherwise have explored, but also it's what I was saying before about how it forces you to describe it for someone else. It forces you to come to that shared vocabulary that's built on like the practical experience of working with people who think about the world at least somewhat differently than you do. And I think that's extremely valuable.
Now let's talk a little bit about the idea of religion and
sure.
I guess Wicca brought in the concept of religion because it is now officially a religion, Wicca. Sure. And how do you, what do you think is the positive and the negative of witchcraft sometimes being combined with the religious aspect? Because I definitely know people that will say, you know, no, I'm a witch and I'm not, you know, a Wiccan and I don't, you know, right. have a religious practice. But what do you think of the positive and negatives of having the two kind of blend sometimes?
Well, okay, let me preface this by, like, I understand Wicca to be sort of a specific initiatory tradition that I guess technically I am an initiate of, but I do not consider myself Wiccan, and I haven't. I considered myself Wiccan for, like, maybe a year. It wasn't a very good fit for me, and I did that because I was told that, like, that's what being a witch is. So I think that's maybe on the con side. I do think that sometimes the religious aspect gets a little forced on people, right? That like, if you're going to be a witch, this is what you have to do. I think that is less true now than it was when like I was starting in like the late 80s and 90s. But on the plus side, I mean, I think framing it in a religious way, I think legitimizes it for many people, right? There is certainly like a practical social benefit to me describing it as a religion that I can't get from it being a craft, right? There are legal protections and et cetera. That's certainly useful, and I make use of that when needed. And I think, like, in as much as there is, like, the thing is, like, religious witchcraft is actually like a whole bunch of different things which maybe aren't that similar to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They all seem mostly fine. Like, I go to those rituals sometimes. They seem nice. Like, I get along with their gods. It seems like, for the most part, in as much as that religion has an impact on people's lives, it convinces them to, like, do good things in the world, a thing that I can't necessarily say about all other religions. Like, but this is a weird thing for a person in a nun habit to say. I myself am quite religious. In general, I think it's better to avoid religion if possible. Like, until the gods demand it of you, I would leave it on the table.
So did the gods demand it of you?
Yeah, yeah. Demand is such a strong... Yeah, yeah, demand. I'm going to go with demand. You know, I've said this before. I consider myself like a lapsed atheist. I grew up atheist, but don't practice anymore. I grew up in Bible country, right? In Amish country, in particular. I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. A beautiful place I am happy to have lived, but do not want to live anymore. And so religion was like unavoidable for me as a kid. You know, we were Jewish, but I will say personally, and I think for many Jews, like I'm not saying all Jews, but I think for me personally and for many, many mainstream Jews, Judaism's only tangentially a religion. It's a cultural practice, right? It's about the traditions of my ancestors. It's about like that communal tribal aspect, right? And that was very like Yiddishkeit, right? Like Kollel Yisrael, the people Israel, was very important to me coming up. And I definitely, so my father was, when I was young, like a militant atheist who sort of settled into agnosticism as he got older. His family is Greek, and I understood my relationship to Greekness and my relationship to Jewishness similarly, in the sense that I understood the God of Israel to be the God of my mother's, and I understood like the Hellenic gods to be the gods of my father's. And that didn't seem problematic. Like those two things had been getting along one way or another, like been in conflict, had grown up braided together for millennia. So like there's a coherence to those kind of Mediterranean, not necessarily in a religious sense, but in a food sense and in a like cultural sense. The ways that my Greek family was different from the WASPs I lived with, and the way my Jewish family was different from the WASPs I lived with, were like basically the same. Like we talk with our hands, we're big and loud, and we eat weird food and do weird stuff and have weird holidays. And so to me, like the religious aspect maybe was less... Like, I was always a religious weirdo, so being a different kind of religious weirdo, like, didn't really make that much impact in my life, right? Like, I grew up with the Greek gods as the gods of my ancestors. I definitely understood those gods to be real in the same way that I understood, like, Jesus to be real. Or any other god to be real, which was like maybe not that much. Like I understood them to be powers in the world that were maybe largely built out of human opinions about them, a position I no longer take. Like I think that there are a lot of kinds of gods, but I think the ones I'm into arise from and abide in the earth itself. Right? Like they are genuine powers in the world, the way lightning is a power in the world. Or the way sound is a power in the world, right? They're just things that exist. And that what turns them into a god is the relationship that you as a person have with them. But I also always came with this understanding that like, that the word god only made sense in a possessive sense, right? That that's my god or not my god. Right? The way that Athena is the goddess of Athenians, the way that Hashem is the god of Israel, the way that Saint Nicholas is a patron of children. Saint Nicholas is such a weird choice there because he's all complicated by Santa Claus. But you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like that a god is a god of something, mm-hmm. right? And it's a god of some people and not of other people.
Right.
Like I was always deeply, deeply skeptical about the idea of a single universal god that was everybody's god. Like that was quite foreign to my understanding. Like I understood Christians appropriated the God of Israel as their God, but I also understood that like maybe that was not the intention of that text or that culture, like that it was pretty specific for some people and not for others. And so that move into paganism was like pretty easy, right? That like I had a relationship with Hashem because he was the God of my mother's people. I had a relationship with Hermes because he was a god of my father's people, but also the god of, as Edith Hamilton would say, mathematicians, thieves, and ne'er-do-wells. And I'm definitely those things. And I had a relationship with Hecate because she was a goddess of witches, right? And so those were my gods, right? So when I first came into I don't know what we call the non-initiatory kind of Wicca, but you know what I'm saying? Like pop Wicca, whatever we call that. Like I came into it. One of the very first books I had, I feel bad. I don't even know the name of this book. It's Ray Buckland's. We used to call it the Big Blue Book of Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo.
I think I know what you mean. Yeah.
Everybody knows what I mean, but nobody knows what that book's about. I think it's called Introduction to Witchcraft or something like that. And it told me that I had to have one he god and one she god.
All right.
Which I was fully prepubescent at that stage. So I didn't really looking back now, I realized that what they wanted me to have was a heterosexual couple. But who I picked was Hermes and Hecate, perhaps the gender queerest lord and lady a person could pick. And I gotta say, I dedicated myself to Hermes and Hecate when I was 11 or 12. And that's been going great. I have never regretted that. They've done great by me, the gods of math and magic and witchcraft and crossroads. That's my jam, and that's going great, right? Their influence in my life has been uniformly positive.
You know who was evidently very influenced and even angered Mercury was Lady Frieda Harris. I was reading, there's a woman that's done who did the talk. There's a woman scholar. I hope to get her on the show. And she's done this research on Lady Frieda Harris, who there's not a lot written about her. So I was so excited.
I don't know that much about her.
And she had this article that goes into her connection to Mercury. And Crowley at one point thinks that she has really somehow offended him. They have this whole conversation about it. And I thought, wow, that's so interesting. I mean, she's ceremonial magician through Crowley. And
I would generally understand most illustrators to be mercurial,
right?
In the sense that they have a relationship with the god of communication, right?
Right.
So all the illustrators I know are tight with Mercury or Hermes or somebody in kind of that general family,
right? But I never thought about the whole male female. Maybe the way I approached that. You're right. I had that introduction too. I thought of it as yin yang, maybe from my Buddhist background, the idea of the balance between the forces. But you're right. It is kind of sort of a heterosexual kind of energy. And of course, there are people that go in and they have dozens of gods they connect to quite happily. And they're good with that,
too.
You know. So I can't do too many because I get confused. But
oh, no, I'm definitely a god slut. I get around.
Yes, sleep around with the gods. And I like that idea you were talking about, you know, I can't that the god, you know, you make it my god. And I was thinking about the idea that the gods need us, and they, by honoring them or working with them, we sort of help them in some capacity, although I'm not sure how, because if they're gods, why would they need us? But in a way, you sort of indirectly sort of indicated that in some of what you were saying.
Well, need is a strong word. I mean, I believe that everything needs everything, right? Like, I believe that sort of Earth, that everything on Earth sort of evolved in this complexly related way, that every time you remove a piece, things get weird, not necessarily in a good way. So, and so like the gods of the earth, I think, are just as much a part of that as humans are, right? Some of them are older, some of them are newer, but like they're all in that mix together. I think, I mean, I can talk about the things that I feel like my gods want from me, which is things that like kind of I want to do anyway, right? Like mm-hmm. there are things that I'm well suited to do, right? So in particular, I think one of the things the gods want from me, I do PR work for the gods a lot. I write books for them and hymns, and I explain them and talk about them and that sort of thing. But also like I have a body and they like don't. So, you know, we talk a lot about like sort of the big name gods, but like most of my personal practice is actually more with like, say, Grandmother Monongahela, like the god of the river outside my, like, very, I can see it out my window. Mm-hmm. I can see her out my window, right? And like, Grandmother Monongahela has like trash in her that I don't think she wants there. And she can move it. She's a river. She can move things, but not as well as somebody with hands can, right? So I think sometimes things that seem very easy to us, like pick up that soda can and get it away from here, like that's not easy for somebody who doesn't have a body. That's not to say it's impossible. Just like most of the kind of feats of divine magic that we might produce in concert with the gods are not impossible for a human to produce without divine intervention, mm-hmm. right? They're just harder. Similarly, I think feats of human intervention are things that a river maybe could do on its own, but it'd be really hard,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think that what they want from us depends on who they are and who we are. I am going to throw this out there, though, because it is, I'm going to call it a pet peeve, but what I really mean is it fills me with fury. People who worship gods of the crossroads, but do not respect or care for people of the crossroads, right? So like gods like Hermes and Hecate and Elegua and any god of the crossroads, like an important part of what they want for you, from you, is well historically documented, right? And also, I don't know, it just seems like pretty obvious, is caring for people of the crossroads, people who live at the crossroads, homeless people, sex workers, drug addicts, thieves, petty charlatans, people who live and work and be at the crossroads. That's who the god of the crossroads is the god of.
Interesting. Would you include certain people with mental health issues? Would that be crossroads? Is that something different?
If they live in the street, then yes. Definitely yes. But I mean, but yes, I also think that many, but not all, particularly the kinds of mental illness that, let me preface this. I don't, like, I'm not a mental health specialist, and I'm sure there's like better language than what I'm about to use. So if I accidentally say something offensive, like I don't quite have the words to say what I'm trying to say here. I'm doing my best. But like the kinds of mental illness that perhaps impinge on the way people perceive reality, right? So things like delusions and what we call delusions and disordered thinking, I think, and maybe paranoia, those I think are very crossroadsy, right? Whereas the kinds that are more about like emotional regulation, maybe I would not necessarily think of as particularly crossroadsy. I would think of them as lunacy, like the power of the moon.
Right.
Right. That blows that into you. But certainly crossroads gods and moon gods are, as you can tell from like Hecate, who is very much both, are tightly related, or Thoth, who is both.
You know, I've never heard anyone say that. And honestly, it makes sense to me with some of the things that have happened in our lives because of one of our deities, the Morgan, that is one of our sort of personal deities. And we've had people living in LA, there's of course a lot of homelessness, but we've had people that have been incredibly helpful momentarily tell us things that were crossroads people that would come up to us. We came here early and they would give us these messages, and it was it happened in both positive and negative ways. One was, you know, very positive. One was sort of a wake up for me to like, hey, you know, you're doing this. And it was just people that were either homeless or half homeless. And I think about that. I said, wow, I never really thought about it being connected directly to, you know, and we've done our, you know, we try to do our share with community work with different times with helping with the homeless and things. But I never really associated it with the crossroad deities. And that's a really insightful thing that you have.
I mean, certainly, at least in Greece, right, which is maybe where I'm like most familiar with the history, there's no question. I mean, that like meals for Dipnon, feast for Hecate is for homeless people. Like that's straight up who eats that. That's what it's for. That's like the understood social function of that ritual. Mm. Right. And I think that I think some of that has been a little lost. I do think that there has been kind of a Instagramification of witchcraft over the last 40 or 50 years, right? That is tied to a desire for social acceptability and legitimacy, which I personally, as a devotee of the crossroads, could not conceivably be less interested in. Mm. Like, not only do I not want social acceptability, I don't think witchcraft is socially acceptable. And I think that when you try and make it socially acceptable, you cut out all the most important parts of it, mm-hmm. which are inherently countercultural, right? Which are inherently devoted to the service of those culture leaves behind, right? That I think that witchcraft in the interests of the rich and powerful, I'm generally not keen on telling people they're witching wrong, but I don't know if you're doing it in the service of the rich and powerful. Maybe you're doing it wrong, which is one of the reasons, you know, sometimes I get asked why I use the word witch as opposed to magician or occultist or sorceress, all of which are things I am. Like, I would not deny being any of those things. I definitely am all of those things. The reason I prefer the word witch is like 90% political. Like, it is to really highlight my solidarity with other people who are going to be burned at the stake, right? And I think I understand the fear-based motivations that underlie the quest for social acceptability. I'm just maybe, I'm not socially acceptable. I can't pass as socially acceptable. Like, I'm real fucking weird. Like, I can get by in polite society if I keep my mouth shut, but not for very long. Like, I'm noticeably weird.
Mm-hmm.
And so are lots of other people, right? And that's, and a witchcraft that leaves those people behind, which I worry often that sort of like the movement to turn it into a religion is founded in that quest for social acceptability, right? That you can be a normal picket fence suburban white folk and also a witch. I don't think you can. Like,
well, you know what's interesting, I agree with you 100%. And one of the I love watching all the witch shows, right? And I know Hollywood is Hollywood, but one of the things that's always troubled me, even as a little girl when I watched Bewitched, which I was rewatching later, is it's very, I don't think there's any long show where the witches want to be witches. Like, they, even in Charmed, they're often saying like, I want to have a normal life. And like, why do you want to? You are a witch. And you know, that Samantha couldn't use her powers, even though she got around it, which I always loved. You know, I said, well, she's going to be a witch no matter what. And of course, her mother was out there all the time as a witch. And when I'm rewatching,
oh,
I'm saying,
Dora,
like,
that's
Dora,
total,
I mean,
was total life
she really like, influenced me.
Watching Bewitch, and I think I'm maybe a little bit younger than you, so I was watching them in like the early 80s, right? So like, you know, that was not a new show. It was clearly like set in, you know, olden times,
right?
Because olden times is not that long ago when you're 8. Woof. I had really no respect for Samantha at all. I didn't understand why she didn't kick that guy to the curb. he seemed terrible. Endora, like, I was team Endora 100%.
Yeah, I realized that's the one that influenced me the most, because mm-hmm. she's just so, and she's also an older woman. She's mm-hmm. very, like, comfortable with her colorful personality. And exactly. And that time, that was actually quite unusual to have on TV. Mm-hmm. An older yeah. woman that had that kind of power and wit, and, you know, so in a way it was yeah. a successful show because of her, I think. And then some of the aunties and stuff are really funny.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But I never, even I'd be watching these shows and like, why do you want to be normal? Isn't it the greatest thing to be a witch on some level?
You know what's so. A great show in that vein, which does not use the word witch, is The Magicians. The Magicians really, and I will say, if you like the show, watch the books or read the books. I like the books even better. But that show really, I think, does a great job of capturing that sense before you find witchcraft that you mm. knew. You knew the whole time it was out there waiting for you, mm. this amazing magical thing, and that you were not normal and you were never going to be normal. And then suddenly you find witchcraft and you're like, oh, this is what I am.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times in these interviews, I get asked, like, how I became a witch, and I can't answer that question, but I remember the moment when I found out there were other witches, and that was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my largely estranged grandfather sent me a gift certificate to, like, a mail order book company for young people out there. You know, there didn't used to be an internet. You couldn't get weird books. I didn't even know they existed, right? Like, I had the mm-hmm. books that were at the library. That was the books I had. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, not a lot of witchcraft in like 1980, not a lot of witchcraft books in the library. So this was probably, let me think, this was probably about 88. He sent me a gift certificate, and in the nonfiction section in that categorized witchcraft, and I knew what nonfiction meant. That meant it was real.
Right.
And I had always known that witches, like in fairy tales, that was real, even if nobody but me knew it.
Huh.
And I was like, mom, are witches real? And she very politely said, there are definitely people who think they're witches, which, to be fair, is how I feel about a lot of people who call themselves witches. There are people who think they're witches. And I was like, can I buy a book? And she's like, yeah, but it'll be disappointing. And she was right. Like, that was Ray Buckland's Big Blue Book of Bidi Bidi Boo, which was great. Of all books I could have landed on, it was probably the best book on the market at that point.
Right.
Like, it did right by me. I learned a lot of important things, also a lot of terrible things. But I really learned that, like, witchcraft is real. You can learn it. It's hard, but you can learn it. And it's, like, written between the lines in, like, history and mythology. And I feel like those things that I got out of that book have served me very, very well.
And since we're talking about learning, tell us quickly about your course coming up.
Yeah, so I teach a bunch of classes, but in particular, I teach an introduction to witchcraft course. As I mentioned, I'm about to finish a cycle, so it's going to start again. Normally, it would start in May, but I'm actually going to be in the UK teaching for most of May, so it's probably not going to start until June. If you want to look it up, it's witchlessons.com. You can see it, and you can also see I have intermediate and advanced level courses as well. People are welcome to put themselves in whatever course they want. The first lesson in most of the courses is free, so you can see what it is. But for the witch class, it's 13 lessons. It's about a year. It's usually 13 months, but objectively, sometimes I have to delay a class, so it's actually sometimes more like 14 months mm-hmm. once I, like, you know, oh, it's a holiday, we'll push it out a week. Oh, I'm sick, push it out a week, and it. Those weeks catch up with you over the course of the year. So it's written lessons and videos with, like, live lectures, but you don't have to come to the, I mean, I think there's great value in coming to live lectures, but you don't have to. You get the videos, you can study at your own pace, and you will definitely meet other witches. Like, I will give you a study buddy. So you will definitely have a co-magician unless you fight hard not to have one. Like, I'm going to nag you a lot about having your study buddy. Yeah, so you can check out the curriculum. The first lesson is free on YouTube. You can look up my name, but you can also just, the easiest way to find me is witchlessons.com. You can get to my books from there, and get to my classes from there, you get to my YouTube, like everything else you can get to from there.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I noticed it's very affordable too. I was really impressed by the curriculum, and I tried the first lesson and I thought it was excellent.
Oh, I'm so glad you liked it.
Yeah, I
try and keep things affordable. And I also have scholarship plans. Like, the scholarships are available. You can email me to set one up. And I'm just going to say, if you think they're very affordable, like this could be more, consider paying more and endowing a scholarship for somebody who can't pay.
Great idea. I love it. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. We've really enjoyed having you, and I always learn something new from all of our guests. And you've got me really thinking about witchcraft as a craft in a very, I think, very positive direction for me. So thank you.
You know what? Can I say one more thing real quick?
Sure.
April 6th through 9 in suburban Baltimore in Maryland, I'm going to be at the Sacred Space Convention. This is, in my opinion, one of the best witchcraft conventions, festival things on the East Coast. It's one of my favorites, so I'd love to see people there.
Great.
It's Sacred Space Convention.
Great. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Sure.
And thank you all for listening in. Join us next time as we continue to explore the esoteric and the obscure together. Have a great week.